Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what are the implications when our DNA becomes a commodity?
And a photographer's images of her daughter spark backlash.
But first, state lawmakers and Governor Hobbs came to agreement on a major piece of water legislation during the recently ended legislative session, the so-called Ag to Urban Bill. But there's another big water-related issue on which they did not reach a deal: rural groundwater. But it wasn't for a lack of interest. With me now to talk about this is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So Governor Hobbs was pretty high on this issue in January, at the beginning of the session. Mm-hmm. What happened? Why did they not come to an agreement on this?
Yeah, beginning of the year, January, she summoned us for this big press conference with a bunch of rural, politicians there behind her, backing her up, and said that this is the year that we're going to get something done on rural groundwater conservation. This is a pressing issue. You know, the aquifers are being depleted. It's 911. We got to do something about this. It's going to happen. And it didn't happen. We kind of looked back and saw the session, why that didn't happen. That bill that she proposed never even, I don't think, got a hearing. So it was basically dead on arrival. There was another attempt, though, by a Republican lawmaker, and that got slightly further, but then died as well.
What was the governor's plan? Like, what did she want to do?
In a nutshell, they want to create these management areas around endangered groundwater basins, which would be called rural management areas, and those areas in which people would be required to cut down on their water use, and there would be new requirements for monitoring and tracking the amount of water. Right now, there's basically nothing on most groundwater basins, in the rural areas at least, because we have metro
The active
AMAs,
management areas, yeah.
Yes, like the one in Phoenix, which we're on top of. So those places have management on top already. It's just rural that's left out.
And what was objectionable about that to the folks who objected to it?
That's a good question. So Dunn's bill, and he's a Republican senator, his was an alternative proposal that was kind of along the same lines, but it was very different in terms of how much water people would be required to cut. So The governor's proposal wants people to cut more of their water use. Dunn's is less. They couldn't come to an agreement on that. But there's also the issue of House Republican Gail Griffin. She's the head of the Natural Resources Committee, and she has been pretty stalwart in not letting stuff like this get through her committee. So that is, according to, you know, folks involved in the process, one of the main issues and reasons why this hasn't moved forward.
Well, like in the world of water policy, how big were the differences between the governor's approach and Senator Dunn's approach? It sounds like, at least from an outsider's perspective, like they were kind of moving in the same direction.
You would think that, right? And for the past few years, this is not exactly an entirely new concept.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this a year ago as well. There was at least an idea of being close to a plan because everyone agrees on the concept, and it really comes down to that main difference. You know, there was some push from at least Mojave County Supervisor Travis Lingenfelter, who's a Republican, that Hobbs should try to leverage Ag to Urban because that's something that urban Arizona wanted to get something on rural groundwater for the rural folks, and that she should use that as a bargaining chip. And that didn't happen. And he was disappointed in that because it was pretty much the only other card to play on groundwater. But, you know, Dunn, for example, wanted to keep those things separate. Hobbs apparently decided not to, and so that didn't work.
So what happens next? Like, obviously, it's like something has to be done about this. As you referenced, some of these groundwater basins are kind of running out of groundwater.
Yeah, and it is a serious problem because, you know, if your well one runs dry and you have to build another one and you have to treat the water and you have to get, you know, further away to get your water, all of that stuff is expensive. Your rates could go up, or you could, you know, just simply have to move away. There's the possibility of putting this on the ballot. You know, citizens can drum up enough support to put this on the ballot and just circumvent the legislature and say, you know, we've had it and we're doing this ourselves. That's a possibility. It's something Lingenfelter mentioned. Hobbs kind of didn't say, you know, she said she's considering all options, which is what they often say.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how real of a possibility that is, but it's kind of the only option if the legislature doesn't move forward on this issue.
Is there anything the governor can do unilaterally? I mean, we saw her take some action in some basins across the state. Like, is this something that she can just do?
Yes and no. She has this one tool in her tool belt, which is the AMAs, which is what urban Arizona already has. But there's resistance to that because rural Arizona doesn't want this urban tool, which is very much designed for urban areas, to be imposed on rural Arizona, where they would want very different requirements. Mm. And she doesn't want that either. Nobody is actually in favor of making AMAs in rural areas. They want rural versions of that. But she's threatened it before. She said, you know what, if you don't let me have anything that's a semblance of a rural groundwater plan, then I'm going to have to create AMAs, which is not what anybody wants, including myself. So get your stuff together.
Is this one of those issues that there's talk of maybe different stakeholders working during the interim over the summer, maybe into the fall, to try to have something ready to go for January when the legislature comes back?
I feel like they always say that, but then when we come back, you know, it's unclear. They have had various meetings over the past few years. I think last session, not the most recent one that just ended, there were more meetings, is my understanding, and then they kind of dribbled off and died.
Hmm.
So,
interesting.
Sadly.
But clearly something that will continue to be, at least, if nothing else, a topic of discussion at the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's been a lot of redirection to talking about ag to urban and how that was this groundwater legislation that really broke barriers and is you know, so consequential. But I think that's largely because they haven't done that much else over the past several decades. And so that's, you know, ag to urban only affects two counties in Arizona and it's voluntary. So you have no idea how many people would participate or how much water it would actually save. So it could be good, but it's not exactly, you know, the behemoth.
Interesting. All right. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Cameron, thank you.
Thank you.
Last month, over 80,000 Maricopa County voters received letters from Recorder Justin Heap's office informing them that the Recorder's office had received notification that these voters had gotten driver's licenses in other states. According to the letter, if they didn't respond in 90 days, they would be moved to the inactive voter list. The problem, as VoteBeat's Jen Feidfield recently reported, is that this wasn't true. The letter had been sent by mistake, and the voters weren't actually in danger of being moved to the inactive voter list. So for more on what happened in this very confusing situation, as well as the broader context, Jen joins us now. Jen, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Jen, what did Heap's office have to say about this mix-up? Were there actually issues with these voters' registration status?
Yes. So these are the 80,000 voters in Maricopa County that actually do need to take action. So if you got one of these letters, just know that you will need to do something to keep voting in state and local elections. This goes back to last summer, the state discovered that they hadn't been collecting voter citizenship for about 200,000 voters in the state over time for the past 20 years on accident. So our state law requires this citizenship proof to vote in state and local elections. This is something that's different from other states where you just have to attest to your citizenship. We have to provide documentation. So the state does not have it on file. Even if you've lived here for 20 years or longer, you might be getting one of these letters in the mail. The problem was that Heap's office accidentally sent this letter that said the incorrect thing, that they had moved out of state. And so now they're getting two letters. They got a second letter in the mail, these voters did, saying, hey, that first letter was a mistake. Here's this super complicated other thing that's going on that you'll have to act
trust
on
us,
now.
Trust us. This is the real letter you need to pay attention to. Well, as I recall, Heap ran on a platform of criticizing the Recorder's office as kind of disorganized and characterized it as an embarrassment for the state. What is he saying about this latest mix-up?
So initially, his office, Recorder Justin Heap's office, said this was all the vendor that they hired to send out these letters, sent out the wrong letter. Come to find out, and 12 News was the first to report this, that actually they did approve the proof for the wrong letter, the office did. So, but these mistakes can happen, right? And this is what Heap is learning. Like you said, he got elected after saying, look at all the mistakes in our elections. I'm going to clean it up. Well, this is what past recorders have said. That's what Adrian Fine DeSantis has said that he had a problem with the contractor when he was in office. You know, this is what the supervisors said when they took power away from Fontes. It's just history repeating itself where people get in office and realize, wow, it is kind of complicated to run elections.
Yes. Turns out, if we learned anything from Parks and Recreation, local government, very complicated.
Very complicated, yes. And, you know, there's these problems where people are now very confused about, you know, their voter status. And if I had one recommendation, it would be before you vote again, whether it's in this special election we have coming up for Congressional District 7 on Tuesday, or just, you know, next November, even the next November, whenever you vote, check your status beforehand and see if everything's okay.
Well, Jen, you were just at the beginning of our conversation sending a message out to voters who may be listening to this and might have received these letters. As I gather, you have heard from some of those voters. What are they saying when they reach out to you?
Well, when they first started getting this incorrect letter, they were completely confused and actually very angry because, you know, obviously they hadn't moved out of state. They were afraid of identity theft because it says, right, you know, hey, your identity is in a different state now. That's very scary with everything going on with, you know, all the hacking going on that you could potentially that could happen to you, but that didn't happen. So that was their first concern. But really, the second letter is just as confusing, and it has been confusing. This is not just Maricopa County. Remember, this is 200,000 across the state. So for months now, I've been writing these articles that are on votebeat.org, you can look it up. Just information articles. If you did get it, this letter, no matter where you are in the state, you do need to provide citizenship proof. It's still confusing because, like I said, they've been here. I've lived here since 1960. What's going on?
Right. Now, Jen, all of this comes as Justin Heap is trying to get more power over local elections in court, right? Where does that effort stand?
Right. So Justin Heap came in and he rejected the contract for who ran what part of the county's elections. He splits these duties with the county supervisors, and he got in and said, no, I want to do things like early in-person voting. I want to be the one to set those locations up. And so they're currently still in this fight over that. He filed a lawsuit about it, and now the supervisors are going to countersue just in a couple days here and ask the court, you know, we need to figure this out. We need to figure out who does what over elections. Help us figure this out so we can actually do that coming up here pretty quickly.
There is also some federal context here, right, Jen? President Trump is seeking to expand the administration's access to citizenship info when people register to vote. What's the latest on that effort?
Right. So Trump came in and he said, listen, the federal law currently, you know, you just have to attest on this form that you're a citizen under penalty of perjury, which, you know, is serious. We don't have evidence that it's a widespread problem. But he came in and said, we need to be proving our citizenship when we register with these documents. So that's part of an executive order that he issued. Now, that executive order, most of it is on hold right now in courts, and it doesn't affect Arizona as much as other states because, again, we're already trying to collect this documentation.
Right.
But, you know, we'll see how that plays out nationally. And I think these letters, because all of that's going on, it caused people to think that something, you know, nefarious was going on where Republicans were trying to remove them from the rolls, and which makes sense with all the federal context. But really, it was just due to the state error.
Now, just about 30 seconds left here, Jen. You mentioned the upcoming special election to fill Congressman Rel Grijalva's seat next week. Is there any indication that in that pool of 200,000 voters who are in limbo here, that any of them are experiencing any similar confusion?
Well, I know that in some counties, you might have had your registration been put on hold if you're on this list. And this is not in Maricopa, but in other counties. If you tried to file an update and didn't provide the citizenship documentation when you did. So you just need to check your record. Make sure everything's okay before Tuesday if you plan to vote in person.
All right. Well, Jen Fifield is a reporter for VoteBeat, keeping us in the loop on all of these very complicated developments. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how a long-term daily project landed one photographer in the middle of a censorship controversy.
I was so proud. I had this stack of, you know, machine prints. And I went to just like a sharing session, like a critique session. And a woman, she's like, you're going to have trouble with this.
We'll hear from an artist on how a personal project can become very provocative.
But first, DNA is the building block of life. It can tell us a lot about both who we are and who we may become. DNA, though, is also increasingly becoming a commodity. Lots of people have given samples to companies that can tell us where we're from and whether we have any family we didn't know about. Researchers find DNA samples helpful in their work studying diseases and potential treatments. But all of this raises a lot of questions, both ethical and otherwise. My next guest thinks about those questions a lot. Gary Marchand is a professor and director of the Center of Law, Science, and Innovation at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. He joins me to talk through this. And Gary, how do you think about our DNA and how we use it and maybe how we use it in financial ways?
Yeah, so our DNA is our sort of recipe for our future. Some people call it the diary of your future. It's very personal, obviously, although you share it with family members, which raises a lot of issues. But it's also incredibly important for the future of healthcare. And so this is a dilemma that it's very private, very personal. But on the other hand, we need literally hundreds of thousands or millions of samples from individuals to do the types of studies that allow us to do what's called precision or personalized medicine, which is going to save, you know, millions of lives. And so how do you weigh that and balance those tensions is a big challenge.
Does it seem as though there's any kind of consensus at this point about what the best and maybe most ethical ways to do this are?
I think most people who are in this area understand the potential here and the benefit, and that we can all benefit. But the question is, how do you assure people that you can they can share their DNA safely and not have it come back to hurt them in some way?
Well, so what are some of the ways that researchers are trying to do that? Because, for example, you know, a researcher could come to me and say, okay, we need to, you know, swab your cheek or right. We want, you know, a saliva sample or something. How do I know that that's not going to be used in some way that either I don't approve of or in a way that might actually be harmful to me?
Yeah, I mean, so that's one of the challenge. And all it takes is a few bad actors once in a while to really undermine confidence in that whole system. One of the key things was in 2009, we passed a federal statute called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. So that ensures that your employer and your health insurer can't use your genetic information to discriminate against you. However, life insurers can, long-term disability insurers can.
Yeah.
Up until now, they haven't been asking for that, but now they're starting to, apparently. We're starting to get reports of people asking. So now it's a problem if even you know your DNA information that you may be required to share it to get life insurance.
Where do some of those commercial companies like 23andMe or you know, other places where you can find out, you know, where your family is from, yeah, or find out if you have long lost relatives you didn't know about? Like, where right. does that fall into all this?
So they're sort of one of the major places that people interact with. So you can go to a research institute and they're constantly at a hospital. If you're getting health care, they'll often ask you if you want to donate your DNA to research. But they're one of the largest, like 23andMe has had something like 14 million Americans give their DNA, including myself. And they're trying to use that for both informing you and your risks and relatives and heritage and ancestry and all those things, but also using that DNA for research to try to advance genetic medicine. And so that's, again, sort of this twofold thing. That company, you know, Ancestry.com does have pretty tight controls, but they got hacked a year and a half ago. And something like, you know, 5 or 6 million people's samples were stolen.
Mm.
And so that's very dangerous, that anytime your data is in some database somewhere, if they're not properly secured, somebody who has mischievous or nefarious intentions can steal it. And that one was sort of really nasty because it seems they were primarily interested in people of certain ethnic groups, Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people. You know, I don't know what they're trying to do with that, but they're apparently offering the data now on the black market from those populations.
And it seems, at least in our minds anyway, that, you know, many people have had information stolen, data hacked.
Yeah.
It just feels like there might be a little bit of a difference between like your social security number or your driver's license number and your DNA.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the individual. So my DNA is, I make it public a lot. I've done like 6 or 7 major tests. I put it on the internet. There's a thing called the personalized medicine thing out of Harvard that they're encouraging very famous people to make their DNA completely available. And if you have a fairly clean DNA, there's not a lot of really interesting or important genes. We thought there might be, but there's actually just a relatively few number of them that maybe predispose you to Alzheimer's or predispose you to breast cancer. If you have those, you might not want to share that. That could lead to discrimination. But my DNA, fortunately, came out pretty clean. Like everybody, I have a lot of variants that could increase my risk, but none of them in a major way. So I just don't see any way someone can use my DNA to hurt me. Now, if I had one of these really dangerous genes or from a small ethnic group where that could maybe used to be used to stereotype, or if I had a gene that predisposed me to criminality, which there's one of, then it'd be different. But for luckily for me, I'm sort of like the great unwashed masses where my DNA isn't that interesting.
But the problem, I would imagine, is that you don't necessarily know that until you get
the results,
right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And it can show up a big surprise.
Yeah. So what was your thought process when you signed up for 23andMe or did any of those other tests?
I'm a geneticist by training. I did genetics. I was a genetics PhD before I went to law school. And so I really believe in the power and the potential of genetic medicine to really improve our healthcare. Our healthcare is really inexact today because we are all different in how we respond to medicines and our risks of different diseases. And if we can tailor our treatments to us, I know it's going to save a lot of lives. So I've always known that and believed in that. And so I was quite willing to have my DNA shared and used for research. But when you start hearing about these hacks or people selling it, perhaps for marketing and other reasons, it does create some concerns.
Are there situations in which companies or researchers or other entities are paying people for their DNA?
No, it's sort of the opposite. So I was one of the early adopters of 23andMe. I think I paid $500.
Wow.
I paid $500 to give them for the privilege of giving them my DNA. And then on average, they then sold that DNA. I gave them permission to do it, to do research, and they've sold it to drug companies for, it's estimated, an average person's DNA for $18,000. So I sort of feel bad I had to pay to give them my DNA that they turned around and sold. But no one's paying for DNA right now.
Is that something that you could see down the road?
Maybe, except the problem is in these studies, you need hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, if you paid, you know, $5, you're in the millions of dollars, and research is incredibly expensive already. A lot of the research can't afford to go forward right now because it is so expensive, and now we're cutting, you know, indirects to research grants and so on. So it's very difficult to make this research go forward and to put on a cost of charging, paying for each DNA sample when you're using hundreds of thousands of them would just be, I think, impractical.
Gary Marchant is a law professor and director of the Center of Law, Science, and Innovation at ASU's Law School. More of our conversation in just a moment.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Let's return now to my conversation about DNA with Gary Marchant, law professor and director of the Center of Law, Science, and Innovation at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. And Gary, I just wonder, for some people, you talk about certain groups of people, a lot of marginalized communities, for example, are seen as having DNA that is potentially valuable for research. I wonder if that might incentivize in some way people to offer their DNA, but also potentially lead to some more ethical questions about paying for something like your DNA.
Yeah, I mean, it raises a lot of issues. One of the things I was hopeful of and may still work is the idea of putting your DNA on a blockchain. And then drug companies and other researchers would actually pay to the blockchain, and you as a donor of that DNA would get a cut of that for using your DNA in research. Now, that I gave my DNA to a company to do that. They haven't put it on a blockchain yet, so I've gotten no returns. And I think several companies have tried this model and nothing's really worked yet. But that could be a model for the future where the people who donate the DNA would actually get part of the payment for the DNA.
That's a really interesting concept. Yeah. And it just seems like, you know, again, you know, we talk about, you know, if you did this, a lot of people paid 23andMe or Ancestry.com, these companies, to find out interesting information. But if I wonder if you're just And I say just because the return to the individual might not be seen for a long time, if ever. If you're giving your DNA for drug research, for example, like I wonder if more people would be willing to do it and maybe take on that risk if they got some amount of money or something tangible in return.
Yeah, I think it would certainly, we know from basic economics that that's a fact, that if you get some kind of reward, you're more likely to do that. All these companies who market different things and give you points and things like that are very aware of that.
Yeah.
So the DNA industry maybe needs to get more sophisticated in their marketing.
In your mind, sort of on a philosophical, maybe ethical level, do companies and researchers maybe need to think about DNA and how they acquire it differently than how they acquire different things, or maybe how a credit card company incentivizes people to spend money on that credit card or something like that?
My sense is that the companies and researchers in this field are very aware and sensitive to this. They know the power of the DNA, and they do try to protect it. It's just that there's no such thing as perfect security of data these days. I think there's been a sense that this stuff is very precious and very personal, and we need to protect it, but there's never going to be a perfect protection.
What do you think the future looks like in this field?
Yeah, I think, in the future, it's quite possible that people will be, when they're born, will be given a disk with their entire genome sequence on it.
Hmm.
The cost of sequencing your entire genome has come down from $100,000 to several hundred dollars now. I've had my whole genome sequenced 4 times now. And, you can then use that for all kinds of things later in your life. For drugs, for example, almost most drugs work better or less better for different genotypes. You can now just look at your chip and determine what is the right dose of this drug, or should I take that drug at all? Drug side effects kill over 100,000 people a year, many of them because you have the wrong genotype for that drug dose. So we could be saving a lot of lives if we had that genome and not have to pay several thousand dollars to get it tested each time we're getting a drug prescription or something. If we just have that once for several hundred dollars and just use it throughout our lifetimes, I think that'll be the future. But of course, we have to assure people that that won't be used against them, that insurers won't use it, that employers won't use it, and other people won't use it to harm you. And so that's really important to build up those legal protections.
Well, and that kind of raises, sort of that age-old question, you ask the teenager or the, young adult, if you could know that at 70 years old you're going to have X disease, would you want to know?
Right.
And if you did know, would it change the way you lived your life?
Right.
It sounds like this is, in your visioning of the future, that's a question that we're all going to have to really seriously consider.
Yes, and people really differ on that. Several years ago, 23andMe offered to test my entire genetics and law class, and 50-something students got tested. And what was remarkable is a diverse response that people had to finding out certain risks they had. Some people were glad to know it because it occurred to them at the moment they were conceived, and they can now be aware of it and try to prevent it. Other people feel guilty, feel stressed, or worry about their parents who gave them the gene, worry about their kids in the future who will receive that gene. So it's so interesting to see how diverse people are and how they respond to this information about their future risks.
So in the scenario you outlined where, you would be given, a disk or a thumb drive or something with your genetic sequence on it, in that kind of situation, could I, if I had that, take it, for example, to my physician and say, he says, okay, you have high blood pressure. You have, our tests show that you have this. Let me see your genetic sequence. Let me see your genome, and we can figure out what medication might work best. If I, for people who have to have surgery, you give it to the hospital so they can make sure there are no other risk factors. Is that kind of what you're talking
about? That's exactly right. And that could be incredibly helpful because, first of all, a lot of drugs don't work for certain patients because they have the wrong genotype. No drug really works in more about half the patients it's given to, some considerably less. And then secondly, there's incredible toxicity from drugs. Drugs are messing your body up to do a good thing, we hope. But for a lot of people, because of the genotype you have, they can cause toxicity and death. And so it hospitalizes over 2 million people a year from drug side effects, kills over 100,000 people. Much of that could be prevented if the doctor could just look on your disc or your record and see which gene variants you have and determine, and it'll just pop up on their screen, what dose of the drug or what drug they should do for you. And some of the top hospitals are now already doing that.
I can imagine that there would be people who would look at this and say, you're basically predetermining somebody's life by having this information. Like a physician from a very young age could say, okay, this person is predisposed to some kind of addiction. This person is predisposed to criminal activity. This person is going to have dementia when they're older, and almost figure out from when a person is, you know, maybe like a year old, what the rest of their life is going to look like.
That's very true. It's sort of a future diary. Of course, the environment plays a big role as well. But I think we have to give people the choice of what information they want. There's a project, for example, that's sequencing the entire genome of new babies, and they give the parents a choice of what kind of information they want about their child. Is it just drug side effects and drug effectiveness, or do you want to know disease risk? Do you want to know some of these social risk factors? So I think people should have the choice of what information they want from their genome. If you're like me and you want it all, you can have it. If you only want very narrow stuff that can basically save your life when you get prescribed a drug, you can have that. And more importantly, that you get to control who else gets to see it.
Interesting. All right. Gary, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to talk to you.
Gary Marchand is a professor at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center of Law, Science, and Innovation there. Steve Benson has died. Benson was the longtime political cartoonist for the Arizona Republic. He joined the paper in 1981. After being laid off from the Republic in 2019, he became the cartoonist for the Arizona Mirror until he retired last year. Benson won the Pulitzer Prize for his work in 1993 and was a finalist for the award a few other times. He was 71 years old. With me to help remember Steve Benson is David Fitzsimmons, the retired cartoonist and columnist for the Arizona Daily Star. David, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So when you think of your friend and fellow cartoonist Steve Benson, I'm sure a million things come to mind. What
yes.
kind of floats to the top of the list for you?
His wonderful mind, his imagination, his good sense of humor. Yeah. And also, you know, his irreverence for just about everything, which was a trait we cartoonists tend to share in common, but also this wonderful reverence for the Constitution and the idea of America, which you would see in his cartoons day after day, even though his cartoons tended to have a negative critical nature, as all of our cartoonists' work tend to have.
Yeah.
Underneath that was a great love for the American idea. And that's a quality I really loved about Steve, because, you know, I accused him sometimes of being as corny as Sheriff Andy Griffith from Mayberry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I got to know him well after he was disgracefully jettisoned from the Republic. I invited him down to our home for a couple of weeks to get his stuff together. And I just sort of fell in love with my friend all over again because of his wonderful sense of humor, his kindness, and particularly his stories about being a cop in Gilbert. He was such a curiously virtuous guy. I just really enjoyed him.
Yeah. So how would you describe his drawing style, his artistic style?
Oh, I would describe, did you hear that sound? Oh,
yeah.
That was, I would describe his drawing style as visually gorgeous. It was rich. We would watch each other draw. That's, you know, strange things cartoonists do, right? When we get together.
Huh.
And his brushwork and his line work was flawless and patient, and he had such a steady hand. It was almost like watching a 18th century Japanese calligrapher work with the brush, the way he could vary the width of the line from thin to thick to visually describe what was in his mind. And what really impressed me about Steve is I tend to use a light table and trace up my drawings until they get better and better and perfect. But he would do it on one sheet of paper without tracing. So
wow.
he was very patient with his imagery, and it showed in his work. It was beautiful. He would sometimes spend up to 12 hours on a drawing. And, you know, I would taunt and tease him about that, about, you know, you're spending your life at the drawing board, brother. And only you notice the difference. But that is because, you know, he had such high standards for himself, as well as those of us around the dear man.
Right. Well, so David, you wrote a very touching tribute to your friend on your Substack. And one of the things that you talked about was the fact that you both received a lot of, let's say, not terribly favorable responses from readers and viewers, people who weren't super thrilled with what you had drawn. Like, how did you guys talk about that? Like, what is, because obviously, like, if you're a political cartoonist, you're gonna get some amount of that.
Yes.
Like, what was, like, how did, and maybe how did he help you evolve in your thinking about getting that kind of mail?
Oh, here's my story. So I met him at an American Association of Editorial Cartoonists conference when I was just a young punk kid. I'm nearly 70 now, but so this was about 35 years ago. And I remember walking up to the bar where a group of cartoonists were enjoying each other, and I was in a whiny mood, and I lamented that, oh, I'm getting hate mail. Oh, it's awful. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And Steve said, brother, you know, that is how you judge your effectiveness, by the hate mail. And he also advised me, you know, don't take it personally. They're upset about your public opinions, and that's sort of your public persona. That's not truly your most private self. I mean, it's a kind of a curious distinction, but that sort of helped me to lighten up, and in fact, begin to chase that kind of mail by creating more provocative cartoons, because the cartoonists want to discourage me from being shy about presenting my honest sentiments, just because some people might disagree with them. Because, as Steve would point out, that is the job of a political cartoonist, to provoke conversation.
Yeah. So just about a minute or so left, David. I want to ask, like, when you think back on maybe what you learned besides how to embrace the hate mail, what
Yes.
would you say that you learned from your friend Steve Benson?
Oh, what I learned from my friend Steve Benson is it is with that, I learned from Steve that myself and he are both, we were both so fortunate in our lives to have this curious gift of the ability to draw and to comment on events of the day with a good sense of humor, with clear, provocative thoughts. And just to cons and we constantly talk about this. Steven mentioned how, and you know, the man was a heathen like myself, but we would use the word blessed from time, how blessed we were to have this curious skill set. And Steve would remind me of this obligation we have to use it for good. That's the corny man again. You know, I recently, I'll make this quick. I recently saw the movie Superman, and I thought of my friend Steve,
Oh, wow.
truth, justice, and the American way. And I thought, man, that's you, brother Steve. That's you.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is David Fitzsimmons, retired cartoonist and columnist for the Arizona Daily Star. David, thanks for your time. Thanks for helping us remember your friend Steve Benson.
My pleasure. Take care.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. ASU professor Betsy Schneider is an artist and filmmaker. And, you know, speaking of art that provokes conversation, Betsy teaches a course on censorship and art. It's a subject she has personal experience with. Back in the 90s, when her daughter was born, Betsy and her then husband started this daily photography project. Twice a day, they took a picture of their daughter. Their daughter was nude in these images. And over the years, Betsy came to see the photographs as a kind of document of human development. She began showing the photographs as a series that she called Quotidian, and right away, it was controversial. As Betsy told me recently, over the years, the Quotidian series has become an evolving lens for her to understand her life as an artist and how people react to her art.
I was so proud. I had this stack of, you know, machine prints. And I went to just like a sharing session, like a critique session. And a woman, she's like, you're going to have trouble with this. And I mean, I knew, you know, certain pictures of children provoked people in certain ways. I mean, I also grew up in the 70s and I was married to a Scandinavian. So childhood nudity also was like, had been, and photography had been really like normalized. So I was really shocked.
Can I just ask, I mean, do I take that correctly to say that the goal for you in making these photographs was not to be provocative?
Yeah, no, you know, a lot of it was about, I mean, really basic, like, wow, look how much a baby changes.
So you do this showing of the work in progress version of Quotidian, and you get this feedback that I think you said the woman says, yeah, you're going to have trouble.
Yeah. And then in 2004, it was actually removed from a show in London.
Were you told it was going to be removed?
Yeah. It was a weird situation where the curator was a friend of mine. Her dad was taking pictures of the installation. Somebody saw a man taking pictures of a naked child, and they reported it to the director, and the director's like, that work needs to be taken down.
Can I just ask, was the man punished for taking the photographs?
No, I mean, he was taking installation shots for the artists, right?
Oh, okay.
The pictures were like, it wasn't even genuinely somebody with prurient interest photographing. I mean, that brings up a whole other level of policing, right? Assuming the worst intent when somebody looks at something. The Kohler Center wasn't even that they thought it was genuinely problematic. It was that they thought other people were going to think it was problematic.
That's interesting. So we should just say the Kohler Center is an art center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Quotidian was ultimately exhibited.
So in 2012, it was part of a larger show at the Kohler Center. It got taken down from the Kohler Center. And just for context, there were some other artists, including Catherine Opie and Ryan McGinley, who are known for making work that pushes boundaries, and specifically in relation to the body. So it was kind of ironic, I think, that we're more threatened by the children's body than the adult body.
And to be clear, their work was not taken down.
No, their work was not taken down. The show actually went on to two other venues, including one at the Weatherspoon in North Carolina, and then the Addison in Andover, Massachusetts. And they included my work, but they contextualized it. My daughter wrote a little text. She was like, it's just normal. It's just like brushing your teeth. So they included this text, and they kind of proactively created a space. Like, look, we know some people might have issues with this. Let's talk about it.
Can I ask, what is your daughter's name?
Madeline.
Madeline. How does Madeline feel about all this, looking back on it?
So maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had her come into a class that I was teaching, and one of the students asked her about the work. And I said, you know, do you want it to be shown? And she said, yeah. She's like, we worked really hard on that. And I mean, this is 25-year-old, you know, at this point, you know, and I was like, wow. I'd always been nervous about calling it a collaboration with her because, you know, an infant is not a collaborator, you know,
and right, it was, right. There was, they can't consent.
Exactly.
Well, can I ask you, Betsy, ahead. There must have come a moment where she was of an age where you could show her the work for the first time and she would have some understanding of what it was.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment and how it went?
So I actually made a video of her looking at it, but by then she was 8, and you know, in this particular video, she's like, well, it's important to you. It's your art. And the problematic nature of her mom interviewing her about something that related to her mom, notwithstanding,
Sure.
That was definitely a moment where I was like, she understands that this is something that we're doing together, but that it's ultimately my thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go to shows, faculty shows where my work would be up. And she didn't like being the center of attention. She's like, it's not about me. We as adults are like, oh, you're naked and you're in public. And her interpretation was like, no, pictures are pictures. I have a whole nother life.
There is this way in which art being censored or generating controversy, even if it's not censored, weirdly attracts more attention to the art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? What's your thought on that piece of all this?
Personally, I've never been able to spin that into gold. I've never been able to be one of those people that took controversy and advanced my career. So
sure.
That's answer number one. Uh-huh. But I mean, I think things are scarier now in ways. Personally, they weren't as scary 20 years ago. And
can you say more about the scariness? What do you mean?
I mean, obviously museums are canceling shows about right. things. Uh-huh. It feels like there's a lot more fear. It's also our job as artists to keep making stuff. We can't expect to be comfortable all the time. Like when I was making that work, I was so confident. I was like, I'm not hurting my kids. I'm making art. It's important art. And I am going to stand behind it. And maybe I'll lose my job. And maybe this will happen. But I stand behind my work.
But let me go back to what you said a moment ago, Betsy, about how maybe, you know, artists need to be aware that they're not always going to be comfortable. It also feels like implicit in what you're saying is that consumers of art need to have an expectation that they're not always going to be comfortable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I heard something recently that freedom and comfort are not the same thing. I mean, I think it's interesting, too, is that, you know, there's been a lot of push towards, well, there was until recently, like towards, you know, identity-driven art. And on one hand was really interesting and good and positive, but it also started to become something that we became comfortable with, the ways that certain groups were portrayed and standing behind certain artists who we felt like made work that reflected our own kind of positive or progressive views of the world. And a lot of us started to get away from and forget that one of the functions of art is to push us towards things that are scary and uncomfortable. And those may be for people who are left-leaning, they may be right-leaning things, or they may be things that don't go left and right and mm-hmm. confuse us a little bit and put us in this ambivalent or ambiguous place.
Can I ask you as a last question, and this is a hypothetical, but let's say that you had completed the work on Quotidian or were in the midst of it, and your daughter had come to you and said, I actually am not comfortable with this being shown, or I don't feel good about the idea of people seeing me this way. How do you think that would have impacted your perspective on this?
Yeah. I mean, I would like to believe I was the kind of person who would say, okay. Mm-hmm. What I probably would have done was find a way to keep doing it and wait until she got to be older and have a conversation. And there's a self-centered nature to art. And I do think that making art out of your own life can be really complicated. It's part of what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
That's an imperfect answer.
It's maybe not a comfortable answer, but it is the answer.
Yeah.
Well, Betsy Schneider is...
Yeah, thank you.
A photographer and a filmmaker. And Betsy, thank you for this uncomfortable but important conversation.
Thank you, Sam.
Mark, you know, there were so many lovely moments in that Steve Benson conversation, but the one that's sticking with me is that David said that Benson was this curiously virtuous man.
That seems like that's a good thing to be called, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take being, you know, somebody who reminds people of truth, justice in the American way, but I would almost rather be curiously virtuous.
Yeah, the Superman comparison's not bad. I'll give you that. That
yeah,
is true.
Yeah, yeah. I'll take either one.
Sure, fair enough. All right, well, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.